scowl like Lee Majors, pretend he was running in slow motion. I was flipping through a worn copy of a Mike Hammer mystery when I heard screaming and glass breaking. I dropped the book and hurried across the street. I found the Wins behind the counter, all the way against the wall, faces ashen, Mr. Wins' arms wrapped around his wife. On the floor, oranges, an overturned magazine rack, a broken jar of beef jerky, and shards of glass at Baba's feet. It turned out that Baba had had no cash on him for the oranges. He had written Mr. Wynn a check, and Mr. Wynn had asked for an ID. "He wants to see my license," Baba bellowed in Farsi. "Almost 2 years we bought his damn fruits and put money in his pocket, and the son of a dog wants to see my license." "Baba, it's not personal," I said, smiling at the Wynns. "They're supposed to ask for an ID." "I don't want you here," Mr. Wynn said, stepping in front of his wife. He was pointing at Baba with his cane. He turned to me. "You're a nice young man, but your father, he's crazy. Not welcome anymore." "Does he think I'm a thief?" Baba said, his voice rising. People had gathered outside. They were staring. "What kind of a country is this? No one trusts anybody." "I call police," Mrs. Wynn said. "You get out, or I call police." "Please, Mrs. Wynn," I said, "don't call the police. I'll take him home. Just don't call the police, okay? Please?" "Yes, you take him home. Good idea," Mr. Wynn said. His eyes, behind his wire-rimmed bifocals, never left Baba. I led Baba through the doors. He kicked the magazine on his way out. After I had made him promise he wouldn't go back in, I returned to the store and apologized to the Wynns. Told them my father was going through a difficult time. I gave Mrs. Wynn our telephone number and address and told her to get an estimate for the damages. "Please call me as soon as you know. I'll pay for everything, Mrs. Wynn. I am so sorry." Mrs. Wynn took the sheet of paper from me and nodded. I saw her hands were shaking more than usual, and that made me angry at Baba. He's causing an old woman to shake like that. "My father is still adjusting to life in America," I said, in way of an explanation. I wanted to tell them that in Kabul, we snapped a tree branch and used it as a credit card. Hassan and I would take the wooden stick to the bread maker. He'd carve notches on our stick with his knife, one notch for each loaf of naan he'd pull for us from the tandoor's roaring flames. At the end of the month, my father paid him for the number of notches on the stick. That was it. No questions, no ID. But I didn't tell them. I thanked Mr. Wynn for not calling the cops. Took Baba home. He sulked and smoked on the balcony while I made rice with chicken neck stew. 1.5 years since we had stepped off the plane from Peshawar, and Baba was still adjusting. We ate in silence that night. After 2 bites, Baba pushed away his plate. I glanced at him across the table, his nails chipped and black with engine oil, his knuckles scraped, the smells of the gas station, dust, sweat, and gasoline on his clothes. Baba was like the widower who remarries, but can't let go of his dead wife. He missed the sugarcane fields of Jalalabad and the gardens of Pakman. He missed people milling in and out of his house. He missed walking down the bustling aisles of Shor Bazaar and greeting people who knew him and his father, knew his grandfather, people who shared ancestors with him, whose pasts intertwined with his. For me, America was a place to bury my memories. For Baba, a place to mourn his. "Maybe we should go back to Peshawar," I said, watching the ice float in my glass of water. We had spent 6 months in Peshawar, waiting for the INS to issue our visas. Our grimy one-bedroom apartment smelled like dirty socks and cat droppings. But we were surrounded by people we knew, at least people Baba knew. He would invite the entire corridor of neighbors for dinner, most of them Afghans waiting for visas. Inevitably, someone would bring a set of tabla and someone else a harmonium. Tea would brew and whoever had a passing singing voice would sing until the sun rose, the mosquitoes stopped buzzing, and clapping hands grew sore. "You're happier there, Baba. It's more like home," I said. "Peshawar was good for me, not good for you," he said. "You work so hard here." "It's not so bad now," he said, meaning since he had become the day manager at the gas station. But I had seen the way he winced and rubbed his wrists on damp days, the way sweat erupted on his forehead as he reached for his bottle of antacids after meals. "Besides, I didn't bring us here for me, did I?" he said. I reached across the table and put my hand on his, my student hand, clean and soft, on his laborer's hand, grubby and calloused. I thought of all the trucks, train sets, and bikes he had bought me in Kabul. Now America. One last gift for Amir. Just 1 month after we arrived in the U.S., Baba found a job off Washington Boulevard as an assistant at a gas station owned by an Afghan acquaintance. He had started looking for work the same week we arrived. 6 days a week, Baba pulled 12-hour shifts pumping gas, running the register, changing oil, and washing windshields. I'd bring him lunch sometimes and find him looking for a pack of cigarettes on the shelves, a customer waiting on the other side of the oil-stained counter, Baba's face drawn and pale under the bright fluorescent lights. The electronic bell over the door would ding-dong when I walked in, and Baba would look over his shoulder, wave, and smile, his eyes watering from fatigue. The same day he was hired, Baba and I went to our eligibility officer in San Jose, Mrs. Dobbins. She was an overweight black woman with twinkling eyes and a dimpled smile. She had told me once that she sang in church, and I believed her. She had a voice that made me think of warm milk and honey. Baba dropped the stack of food stamps on her desk. "Thank you, but I don't want," Baba said. "I work always. In Afghanistan I work, in America I work. Thank you very much, Mrs. Dobbins, but I don't like it free money." Mrs. Dobbins blinked. She picked up the food stamps and looked from me to Baba like we were pulling a prank, or slipping her a trick, as Hassan used to say. 15 years I've been doing this job and nobody's ever done this," she said. And that was how Baba ended those humiliating food stamp moments at the cash register and alleviated one of his greatest fears, that an Afghan would see him buying food with charity money. Baba walked out of the welfare office like a man cured of a tumor. That summer of 1983, I graduated from high school at the age of 20. By far the oldest senior tossing his mortarboard on the football field that day. I remember losing Baba in the swarm of families, flashing cameras, and blue gowns. I found him near the 20-yard line, hands shoved in his pockets, camera dangling on his chest. He disappeared and reappeared behind the people moving between us, squealing blue-clad girls hugging and crying, boys high-fiving their fathers and each other. Baba's beard was graying, his hair thinning at the temples, and hadn't he been taller in Kabul? He was wearing his brown suit, his only suit, the same one he wore at Afghan weddings and funerals, and the red tie I had bought him for his 50th birthday that year. Then he saw me and waved, smiled. He motioned for me to wear my mortarboard and took a picture of me with the school's clock tower in the background. I smiled for him. In a way, this was his day more than mine. He walked to me, curled his arm around my neck, and gave my brow a single kiss. "I am Muftakhir, Amir," he said, proud. His eyes gleamed when he said that, and I liked being on the receiving end of that look. He took me to an Afghan kebab house in Hayward that night and ordered far too much food. He told the owner that his son was going to college in the fall. I had debated him briefly about that just before graduation. I told him I wanted to get a job, help out and save some money, maybe go to college the following year. But he had shot me one of his smoldering Baba looks, and the words had vaporized on my tongue. After dinner, Baba took me to a bar across the street from the restaurant. The place was dim, and the acrid smell of beer I'd always disliked permeated the walls. Men in baseball caps and tank tops played pool, clouds of cigarette smoke hovering over the green tables, swirling in the fluorescent light. We drew looks, Baba in his brown suit and me in pleated slacks and sports jacket. We took a seat at the bar, next to an old man, his leathery face sickly in the blue glow of the Michelob sign overhead. Baba lit a cigarette and ordered us beers. "Tonight, I am too much happy," he announced to no one and everyone. "Tonight, I drinking with my son, and one please for my friend," he said, patting the old man on the back. The old fellow tipped his hat and smiled. He had no upper teeth. Baba finished his beer in three gulps and ordered another. He had three before I forced myself to drink a quarter of mine. By then, he had bought the old man a scotch and treated a foursome of pool players to a pitcher of Budweiser. Men shook his hand and clapped him on the back. They drank to him. Someone lit a cigarette. Baba loosened his tie and gave the old man a handful of quarters. He pointed to the jukebox. "Tell him to play his favorite songs," he said to me. The old man nodded and gave Baba a salute. Soon, country music was blaring, and just like that, Baba had started a party. At one point, Baba stood and raised his beer, spilling it on the sawdust floor, and yelled, "Fuck the Russia!" The bar's laughter and then its full-throated echo followed. Baba bought another round of pitchers for everyone. When we left, everyone was sad to see him go. Kabul, Peshawar, Hayward. Same old Baba, I thought, smiling. I drove us home in Baba's old ochre-yellow Buick Century. Baba dozed off on the way, snoring like a jackhammer. I smelled tobacco on him and alcohol, sweet and pungent. But he sat up when I stopped the car and said in a hoarse voice, "Keep driving to the end of the block." "Why, Baba?" "Just go," he said. He had me park at the south end of the street. He reached in his coat pocket and handed me a set of keys. "There," he said, pointing to the car in front of us. It was an old Model Ford, long and wide, a dark color I couldn't discern in the moonlight. "It needs painting," he said, "and I'll have one of the guys at the station put in new shocks, but it runs." I took the keys, stunned. I looked from him to the car. "You'll need it to go to college," he said. I took his hand in mine and squeezed it. My eyes were tearing over, and I was glad for the shadows that hid our faces. "Thank you, Baba." We got out and sat inside the Ford. It was a Gran Torino. Navy blue, Baba said. I drove it around the block, testing the brakes, the radio, and the turn signals. I parked it in the lot of our apartment building and shut off the engine. "Tashakur, Baba John," I said. I wanted to say more and tell him how touched I was by his act of kindness, how much I appreciated all that he had done for me, all that he was still doing. But I knew I'd embarrass him. "Tashakur," I repeated instead. He smiled and leaned back against the headrest, his forehead almost touching the ceiling. We didn't say anything, just sat in the dark, listened to the tink-tink of the engine cooling, the wail of a siren in the distance. Then Baba rolled his head toward me. "I wish Hassan had been with us today," he said. A pair of steel hands closed around my windpipe at the sound of Hassan's name. I rolled down the window, waited for the steel hands to loosen their grip. I would enroll in junior college classes in the fall, I told Baba the day after graduation. He was drinking cold black tea and chewing cardamom seeds, his personal trusted antidote for hangover headaches. "I think I'll major in English," I said. I winced inside, waiting for his reply. "English," he said. "Creative writing," I said. He considered this and sipped his tea. "Stories, you mean. You'll make up stories." I looked down at my feet. "They pay for that, making up stories?" "If you're good," I said, And if you get discovered, how likely is that, getting discovered? He said. It happens, I said. He nodded. And what will you do while you wait to get good and get discovered? How will you earn money? If you marry, how will you support your khanum? I couldn't lift my eyes to meet his. I'll find a job. Oh, he said, wah wah. So if I understand, you'll study several years to earn a degree, and then you'll get a chatty job like mine, one you could just as easily land today, on the small chance that your degree might, someday, help you get discovered. He took a deep breath and sipped his tea. He grunted something about medical school, law school, and real work. My cheeks burnt, and guilt coursed through me, the guilt of indulging myself at the expense of his ulcer, his black fingernails, and aching wrists. But I would stand my ground, I decided. I didn't want to sacrifice for Baba anymore. The last time I had done that, I had damned myself. Baba sighed, and this time tossed a whole handful of cardamom seeds in his mouth. Sometimes, I got behind the wheel of my Ford, rolled down the windows, and drove for hours, from the East Bay to the South Bay, up the peninsula and back. I drove through the grids of cottonwood-lined streets in our Fremont neighborhood, where people who had never shaken hands with kings lived in shabby, flat, one-story houses with barred windows, where old cars like mine dripped oil on blacktop driveways. Pencil-gray chain-link fences closed off the backyards in our neighborhood. Toys, ball tires, and beer bottles with peeling labels littered bare dirt unkempt front lawns. I drove past tree-shaded parks that smelled like bark, past strip malls big enough to hold five simultaneous buzkashi tournaments. I drove the Torino up the hills of Los Altos, idling past estates with picture windows and silver lions guarding the wrought iron gates, homes with cherub fountains lining the manicured walkways and no four Torinos in the driveways, homes that made Baba's house in Wazir Akbar Khan look like a servant's hut. I'd get up early some Saturday mornings and drive south on Highway 17 and push the Ford up the winding road through the mountains to Santa Cruz. I would park by the old lighthouse and wait for sunrise, sit in my car, and watch the fog banks rolling in from the sea. In Afghanistan, I had only seen the ocean at the cinema. Sitting in the dark next to Hassan, I had always wondered if it was true what I had read, that sea air smelled like salt. I used to tell Hassan that someday we'd walk on a strip of seaweed-strewn beach, sink our feet in the sand, and watch the water recede from our toes. The first time I saw the Pacific, I almost cried. It was as vast and blue as the oceans on the movie screens of my childhood. Sometimes, in the early evening, I parked a car and walked up a freeway overpass. My face pressed against the fence, I would try to count the blinking red taillights inching along, stretching as far as my eyes could see. BMWs, Saabs, Porsches, cars I had never seen in Kabul, where most people drove Russian Volgas, old Opals, or Iranian Pecans. Almost 2 years had passed since we had arrived in the U.S., and I was still marveling at the size of this country, its vastness. Beyond every freeway lay another freeway, beyond every city another city, hills beyond mountains, and mountains beyond hills, and beyond those, more cities and more people. Long before the Rusi army marched into Afghanistan, long before villages were burnt and schools destroyed, long before mines were planted like seeds of death and children buried in rock-piled graves, Kabul had become a city of ghosts for me, a city of hair-lipped ghosts. America was different. America was a river, roaring along, unmindful of the past. I could wade into this river, let my sins drown to the bottom, let the waters carry me someplace far, someplace with no ghosts, no memories, and no sins. If for nothing else, for that, I embraced America. The following summer, the summer of 1984, the summer I turned 21, Baba sold his Buick and bought a dilapidated 71 Volkswagen bus for $550 from an old Afghan acquaintance who had been a high school science teacher in Kabul. The neighbors' heads turned the afternoon the bus sputtered up the street and farted its way across our lot. Baba killed the engine and let the bus roll silently into our designated spot. We sank in our seats and laughed until tears rolled down our cheeks, and more importantly, until we were sure the neighbors weren't watching anymore. The bus was a sad carcass of rusted metal, shattered windows replaced with black garbage bags, balding tires, and upholstery shredded down to the springs. But the old teacher had reassured Baba that the engine and transmission were sound, and on that account, the man hadn't lied. On Saturdays, Baba woke me up at dawn. As he dressed, I scanned the classifieds in the local papers and circled the garage sale ads. We mapped our route, Fremont, Union City, Newark, and Hayward first, then San Jose, Milpitas, Sunnyvale, and Campbell if time permitted. Baba drove the bus, sipping hot tea from the thermos, and I navigated. We stopped at garage sales and bought knickknacks that people no longer wanted. We haggled over old sewing machines, one-eyed Barbie dolls, wooden tennis rackets, guitars with missing strings, and old Electrolux vacuum cleaners. By mid-afternoon, we'd filled the back of the VW bus with used goods. Then early Sunday mornings, we drove to the San Jose flea market off Berryessa, rented a spot, and sold the junk for a small profit. A Chicago record that we had bought for a quarter the day before might go for a dollar, or $4 for a set of five. A ramshackle Singer sewing machine purchased for $10 might, after some bargaining, bring in $25. By that summer, Afghan families were working an entire section of the San Jose flea market. Afghan music played in the aisles of the used goods section. There was an unspoken code of behavior among Afghans at the flea market. You greeted the guy across the aisle, you invited him for a bite of potato bolognese or a little kabuli, and you chatted. You offered tasali, condolences, for the death of a parent, congratulated the birth of children, and shook your head mournfully when the conversation turned to Afghanistan and the Rusis, which it inevitably did. But you avoided the topic of Saturday, because it might turn out that the fellow across the aisle was the guy you had nearly blindsided at the freeway exit yesterday in order to beat him to a promising garage sale. The only thing that flowed more than tea in those aisles was Afghan gossip. The flea market was where you sipped green tea with almond kulchas and learned whose daughter had broken off an engagement and run off with her American boyfriend, who used to be Parchami, a communist, in Kabul, and who had bought a house with under-the-table money while still on welfare. Tea, politics, and scandal, the ingredients of an Afghan Sunday at the flea market. I ran the stand sometimes as Baba sauntered down the aisle, hands respectfully pressed to his chest, greeting people he knew from Kabul. Mechanics and tailors selling hand-me-down wool coats and scraped bicycle helmets, alongside former ambassadors, out-of-work surgeons, and university professors. One early Sunday morning in July of 1984, while Baba set up, I bought two cups of coffee from the concession stand and returned to find Baba talking to an older, distinguished-looking man. I put the cups on the rear bumper of the bus, next to the Reagan Bush for 84 sticker. "Amir," Baba said, motioning me over. "This is General Sahib, Mr. Iqbal Tahiri. He was a decorated general in Kabul. He worked for the Ministry of Defense." Tahiri. Why did the name sound familiar? The general laughed like a man used to attending formal parties where he had laughed on cue at the minor jokes of important people. He had wispy silver-gray hair combed back from his smooth, tanned forehead and tufts of white in his bushy eyebrows. He smelled like cologne and wore an iron-gray three-piece suit, shiny from too many pressings. The gold chain of a pocket watch dangled from his vest. "Such a lofty introduction," he said, his voice deep and cultured. "Salam, Bachim." "Hello, my child." "Salam, General Sahib," I said, shaking his hand. His thin hands belied a firm grip, as if steel hid beneath the moisturized skin. "Amir is going to be a great writer," Baba said. I did a double take at this. "He has finished his first year of college and earned A's in all of his courses." "Junior college," I corrected him. "Mashallah," General Tahiri said. "Will you be writing about our country, history perhaps, economics?" "I write fiction," I said, thinking of the dozen or so short stories I had written in the leather-bound notebook Rahim Khan had given me, wondering why I was suddenly embarrassed by them in this man's presence. "Ah, a storyteller," the general said. "Well, people need stories to divert them at difficult times like this." He put his hand on Baba's shoulder and turned to me. "Speaking of stories, your father and I hunted pheasant together one summer day in Jalalabad," he said. "It was a marvelous time. If I recall correctly, your father's eye proved as keen in the hunt as it had in business." Baba kicked the wooden tennis racket on our tarpaulin spread with the toe of his boot. "Some business," he said. General Tahiri managed a simultaneously sad and polite smile, heaved a sigh, and gently patted Baba's shoulder. "Zindagi migzara," he said. "Life goes on." He turned his eyes to me. "We Afghans are prone to a considerable degree of exaggeration, Bachim, and I have heard many men foolishly labeled great. But your father has the distinction of belonging to the minority who truly deserves the label." This little speech sounded to me the way his suit looked, often used and unnaturally shiny. "You're flattering me," Baba said. "I am not," the general said, tilting his head sideways and pressing his hand to his chest to convey humility. "Boys and girls must know the legacy of their fathers. Do you appreciate your father, Bachim? Do you really appreciate him?" "Bale, General Sahib, I do," I said, wishing he would not call me my child. "Then congratulations," he said. "You are already halfway to being a man." He said this with no trace of humor, no irony, the compliment of the casually arrogant. "Padarjan, you forgot your tea." A young woman's voice. She was standing behind us, a slim-hipped beauty with velvety coal-black hair, an open thermos and styrofoam cup in her hand. I blinked, my heart quickening. She had thick black eyebrows that touched in the middle like the arched wings of a flying bird, and the gracefully hooked nose of a princess from old Persia. Maybe that of Tahmina, Rustam's wife and Sohrab's mother from the Shahnameh. Her eyes, walnut brown and shaded by fanned lashes, met mine. Held for a moment, flew away. "You are so kind, my dear," General Tahiri said. He took the cup from her. Before she turned to go, I saw she had a brown sickle-shaped birthmark on the smooth skin just above her left jawline. She walked to a dull gray van 2 aisles away and put the thermos inside. Her hair spilled to one side when she kneeled amid boxes of old records and paperbacks. "My daughter, Soraya John," General Tahiri said. He took a deep breath like a man eager to change the subject and checked his gold pocket watch. "Well, time to go and set up." He and Baba kissed on the cheek, and he shook my hand with both of his. "Best of luck with the writing," he said, looking me in the eye. His pale blue eyes revealed nothing of the thoughts behind them. For the rest of that day, I fought the urge to look toward the gray van. It came to me on our way home. Tahiri. I knew I'd heard that name before. "Wasn't there some story floating around about Tahiri's daughter?" I said to Baba, trying to sound casual. "You know me," Baba said, inching the bus along the queue exiting the flea market. talk turns to gossip and I walk away. But there was, wasn't there? I said. Why do you ask? He was looking at me coyly. I shrugged and fought back a smile. Just curious, Baba. Really? Is that all? He said, his eyes playful, lingering on mine. Has she made an impression on you? I rolled my eyes. Please, Baba. He smiled and swung the bus out of the flea market. We headed for Highway 680. We drove in silence for a while. All I've heard is that there was a man once, and things didn't go well. He said this gravely, like he had disclosed to me that she had breast cancer. Oh, I said. I hear she's a decent girl, hard working and kind. But no khastigars, no suitors, have knocked on the general's door since. Baba sighed. It may be unfair, but what happens in a few days, sometimes even a single day, can change the course of a whole lifetime, Amir, he said. Lying awake in bed that night, I thought of Soraya Tahiri's sickle-shaped birthmark, her gently hooked nose, and the way her luminous eyes had fleetingly held mine. My heart stuttered at the thought of her, Soraya Tahiri, my swap meet princess. In Afghanistan, Yalda is the first night of the month of Jadi, the first night of winter and the longest night of the year. As was the tradition, Hassan and I used to stay up late, our feet tucked under the kursi, while Ali tossed apple skin into the stove and told us ancient tales of sultans and thieves to pass that longest of nights. It was from Ali that I learned the lore of Yalda, that bedeviled moths flung themselves at candle flames, and wolves climbed mountains looking for the sun. Ali swore that if you ate watermelon the night of Yalda, you wouldn't get thirsty the coming summer. When I was older, I read in my poetry books that Yalda was the starless night tormented lovers kept vigil, enduring the endless dark and waiting for the sun to rise and bring with it their loved one. After I met Soraya Tahiri, every night of the week became a Yalda for me. And when Sunday mornings came, I rose from bed, Soraya Tahiri's brown-eyed face already in my head. In Baba's bus, I counted the miles until I would see her sitting barefoot, arranging cardboard boxes of yellowed encyclopedias, her heels white against the asphalt, silver bracelets jingling around her slender wrists. I'd think of the shadow her hair cast on the ground when it slid off her back and hung down like a velvet curtain. Soraya, swap meet princess, the morning sun to my Yalda. I invented excuses to stroll down the aisle, which Baba acknowledged with a playful smirk, and pass the Tahiri's stand. I would wave at the general, perpetually dressed in his shiny, overpressed gray suit, and he would wave back. Sometimes he'd get up from his director's chair and we'd make small talk about my writing, the war, the day's bargains. And I'd have to will my eyes not to peel away, not to wander to where Soraya sat reading a paperback. The general and I would say our goodbyes, and I'd try not to slouch as I walked away. Sometimes she sat alone, the general off to some other row to socialize, and I would walk by, pretending not to know her, but dying to. Sometimes she was there with a portly middle-aged woman with pale skin and dyed red hair. I promised myself that I would talk to her before the summer was over. But schools reopened, the leaves reddened, yellowed, and fell, the rains of winter swept in and wakened Baba's joints, baby leaves sprouted once more, and I still hadn't had the heart, the dil, to even look her in the eye. The spring quarter ended in late May of 1985. I aced all of my general education classes, which was a minor miracle given how I'd sit in lectures and think of the soft hook of Soraya's nose. Then, one sweltering Sunday that summer, Baba and I were at the flea market, sitting at our booth, fanning ourselves with newspapers. Despite the sun bearing down like a branding iron, The market was crowded that day, and sales had been strong. It was only 12:30, but we'd already made $160. I got up, stretched, and asked Baba if he wanted a Coke. He said he'd love one. "Be careful, Amir," he said as I began to walk.
"Of what, Baba?"
"I'm not an ahmak, so don't play stupid with me."
"I don't know what you're talking about," I said.
"Remember this," Baba said, pointing at me. "The man is a Pashtun to the root. He has Nang and Namus."
Nang, Namus,
honor and pride, the tenets of Pashtun men, especially when it came to the chastity of a wife or a daughter. "I'm only going to get us drinks. Just don't embarrass me, that's all I ask," he said.
"I won't. God, Baba."
Baba lit a cigarette and started fanning himself again. I walked toward the concession booth initially, then turned left at the t-shirt stand, where for $5 you could have the face of Jesus, Elvis, Jim Morrison, or all three pressed on a white nylon t-shirt. Mariachi music played overhead, and I smelled pickles and grilled meat. I spotted the Tahiri's gray van, two rows from ours, next to a kiosk selling mango on a stick. She was alone, reading. White ankle-length summer dress today, open-toed sandals, hair pulled back and crowned with a tulip-shaped bun. I meant to simply walk by again, and I thought I had, except suddenly I was standing at the edge of the Tahiri's white tablecloth, staring at Suraya across curling irons and old neckties. She looked up.
"Salam," I said.
"I'm sorry to be muzahem. I didn't mean to disturb you."
"Salam," she said.
"Is General Sahib here today?" My ears were burning. I couldn't bring myself to look her in the eye.
"He went that way," she said, pointed to her right. The bracelet slipped down to her elbow, silver against olive.
"Will you tell him I stopped by to pay my respects?" I said.
"I will."
"Thank you," I said.
"Oh, and my name is Amir, in case you need to know, so you can tell him that I stopped by to pay my respects."
"Yes." I shifted on my feet and cleared my throat.
"I'll go now. Sorry to have disturbed you."
"Nay, you didn't," she said.
"Oh, good."
I tipped my head and gave her a half smile. "I'll go now." Hadn't I already said that?
"Khuda hafiz."
"Khuda hafiz," she replied. I began to walk, stopped and turned. I said it before I had a chance to lose my nerve. "Can I ask you what you're reading?"
She blinked.
I held my breath. Suddenly, I felt the collective eyes of the flea market Afghans shift to us. I imagined a hush falling, lips stopping in mid-sentence, heads turning, eyes narrowing with keen interest.
What was this?
Up to that point, our encounter could have been interpreted as a respectful inquiry, one man asking for the whereabouts of another man. But I had asked her a question, and if she answered, we'd be chatting. Me, a mujarrad, a single young man, and she, an unwed young woman. One with a history, no less. This was teetering dangerously on the verge of gossip material, and the best kind of it. Poison tongues would flap, and she would bear the brunt of that poison, not me. I was fully aware of the Afghan double standard that had favored my gender for centuries. Not, "Did you see him chatting with her?" But, "Did you see how she wouldn't let him go? What a luchak!" By Afghan standards, my question had been bold. With it, I had bared myself and left little doubt as to my interest in her. But I was a man, and all I had risked was a bruised ego. Bruises healed. Reputations did not. Would she take my dare? She turned the book so the cover faced me. Wuthering Heights.
"Have you read it?" she said.
I nodded.
I could feel the pulsating beat of my heart behind my eyes. It's a sad story. Sad stories make good books, she said. They do. I heard that you write. How did she know? I wondered if her father had told her. Maybe she had asked him. I immediately dismissed both scenarios as absurd. Fathers and sons could talk freely about women. But no Afghan girl, no decent and muhtaram Afghan girl at least, queried her father about a young man. And no father, especially a Pashtun with nang and namus, would discuss a mujarrad with his daughter. Not unless the fellow in question was also a khastagar, a suitor who had done the honorable thing and sent his father to knock on the door. Incredibly, I heard myself say, "Would you like to read one of my stories?" "I would like that," she said. I sensed an unease in her now, saw it in the way her eyes began to flick side to side. Maybe checking for the general. I wonder what he would say if he found me speaking for such an inappropriate length of time with his daughter. "Maybe I'll bring you one someday," I said. I was about to say more when the woman I had seen on occasion with Suraya came walking up the aisle. She was carrying a plastic bag full of fruits. When she saw us, her eyes bounced from Suraya to me and back. She smiled. "Amirjan, good to see you," she said, unloading the bag on the tablecloth. Her brow glistened with a sheen of sweat. Her red hair, coiffed like a helmet, glittered in the sunlight. I could see bits of her scalp where the hair had thinned. She had small green eyes buried in a cabbage-round face, capped teeth, and little fingers like sausages. A golden Allah rested on her chest, the chain burrowed under the skin tags and folds of her neck. "I am Jamila, Suraya John's mother," she said. "Salam, Khala John," I said, embarrassed, as I often was around Afghans, that she knew me, and I had no idea who she was. "How's your father?" she said. "He's well, thank you," I said. "You know your grandfather, Qazi Sahib, the judge? Now his uncle and my grandfather were cousins," she said. "So you see, we're related." She smiled, and I noticed the right side of her mouth drooping a little. Her eyes moved between Suraya and me again. I had asked Baba once why General Tahiri's daughter hadn't married yet. "No suitors," Baba said. "No suitable suitors," he amended. But he wouldn't say more. Baba knew how lethal idle talk could prove to a young woman's prospects of marrying well. Afghan men, especially those from reputable families, were fickle creatures. A whisper here, an insinuation there, and they fled, like startled birds. So weddings had come and gone, and no one had sung Ahistaburo for Suraya, and no one had painted her palms with henna, and no one had held a Quran over her headdress. And it had been General Tahiri who had danced with her at every wedding. And now this woman, this mother, with her heartbreakingly eager, crooked smile and the barely veiled hope in her eyes. I cringed a little at the position of power I'd been granted, and all because I had won at the genetic lottery that had determined my sex. I could never read the thoughts in the general's eyes, but I knew this much about his wife. If I was going to have an adversary in this, whatever this was, it would not be her. "Sit down, Amirjan," she said. "Suraya, get him a chair, Bachim, and wash one of those peaches. They're sweet and fresh." "Nay, thank you," I said. "I should get going. My father's waiting." "Oh," Khanum Tahiri said, clearly impressed that I had done the polite thing and declined the offer. "Then here, at least have this." She threw a handful of kiwis and a few peaches into a paper bag and insisted I take them. "Carry my salam to your father," she said, "and come back to see us again." "I will, thank you, Khala John." Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Suraya looking away. "I thought you were getting cokes," Baba said, taking the bag of peaches from me. He was looking at me in a simultaneously serious and playful way. I began to make something up, but he bit into a peach and waved his hand. "Don't bother, Amir. Just remember what I said." That night in bed, I thought of the way dappled sunlight had danced in Suraya's eyes, and of the delicate hollows above her collarbone. I replayed our conversation over and over in my head. Had she said, "I heard you write," or "I heard you're a writer"? Which was it? I tossed in my sheets and stared at the ceiling, dismayed at the thought of 6 laborious, interminable nights of Yalda until I saw her again. It went on like that for a few weeks. I'd wait until the general went for a stroll, then I'd walk past the Tahiri's stand. If Khanum Tahiri was there, she'd offer me tea and a kulcha, and we'd chat about Kabul in the old days, the people we knew, her arthritis. Undoubtedly, she had noticed that my appearances always coincided with her husband's absences, but she never let on. "Oh, you just missed your kaka," she'd say. I actually liked it when Khanum Tahiri was there, and not just because of her amiable ways. Suraya was more relaxed, more talkative with her mother around, as if her presence legitimized whatever was happening between us, though certainly not to the same degree that the generals would have. Khanum Tahiri's chaperoning made our meetings, if not gossip-proof, then less gossip-worthy, even if her borderline fawning on me clearly embarrassed Suraya. One day, Suraya and I were alone at their booth, talking. She was telling me about school, how she too was working on her general education classes at Ohlone Junior College in Fremont. "What will you major in?" I said. "I want to be a teacher." "Really? Why?" "I always wanted to," she said. "When we lived in Virginia, I became ESL certified, and now I teach at the public library one night a week. My mother was a teacher too, and she taught Farsi and history at Zarghuna High School for girls in Kabul." A pot-bellied man in a deerstalker hat offered $3 for a $5 set of candlesticks, and Suraya let him have it. She dropped the money in a little candy box by her feet. She looked at me shyly. "I want to tell you a little story," she said, "but I'm a little embarrassed about it." "Tell me." "Well, it's kind of silly. Please tell me." She laughed. "Well, when I was in fourth grade in Kabul, my father hired a woman named Ziba to help around the house. She had a sister in Iran, in Mashhad, and since Ziba was illiterate, she'd ask me to write her sister letters once in a while. And when the sister replied, I'd read her letter to Ziba. One day, I asked her if she'd like to learn to read and write. She gave me this big smile, crinkling her eyes, and said she'd like that very much. So we'd sit at the kitchen table after I was done with my own schoolwork, and I'd teach her Alif Bey. I remember looking up sometimes in the middle of homework and seeing Ziba in the kitchen, stirring meat in the pressure cooker, then sitting down with a pencil to do the alphabet homework I had assigned to her the night before. Anyway, within a year, Ziba could read children's books. We sat in the yard, and she read me the tales of Dara and Sara, slowly but correctly. She started calling me Muallim Suraya, Teacher Suraya. She laughed again. I know it sounds childish, but the first time Ziba wrote her own letter, I knew there was nothing else I'd ever want to be but a teacher. I was so proud of her, and I felt I had done something really worthwhile, you know? "Yes," I lied. I thought of how I had used my literacy to ridicule Hassan, how I had teased him about big words he didn't know. "My father wants me to go to law school," she said, "and my mother's always throwing hints about medical school, but I'm going to be a teacher. Doesn't pay much here, but it's what I want." "My mother was a teacher too," I said. "I know," she said. "My mother told me." Then her face reddened with a blush at what she had blurted, at the implication of her answer, that Amir conversations took place between them when I wasn't there. It took an enormous effort to stop myself from smiling. "I brought you something," I said. I fished a roll of stapled pages from my back pocket, as promised. I handed her one of my short stories.
"Oh, you remembered," she said, actually beaming. "Thank you."
I barely had time to register that she had addressed me with "tu" for the first time and not the formal "shoma," because suddenly her smile vanished. The color dropped from her face and her eyes fixed on something behind me. I turned around and came face to face with General Tahiri.
"Amir John, our aspiring storyteller, what a pleasure," he said.
He was smiling thinly.
"Salam, General Sahib," I said through heavy lips.
He moved past me toward the booth.
"What a beautiful day it is, nay?" he said, thumb hooked in the breast pocket of his vest, the other hand extended toward Saraya.
She gave him the pages.
"They say it will rain this week. Hard to believe, isn't it?"
He dropped the rolled pages in the garbage can, turned to me, and gently put a hand on my shoulder. We took a few steps together.
"You know, Bachim, I have grown rather fond of you. You are a decent boy, I really believe that. But..."
He sighed and waved a hand.
"Even decent boys need reminding sometimes. So it's my duty to remind you that you are among peers in this flea market."
He stopped. His expressionless eyes bore into mine.
"You see, everyone here is a storyteller."
He smiled, revealing perfectly even teeth.
"Do pass my respects to your father, Amir John."
He dropped his hand, smiled again.
"What's wrong?" Baba said.
He was taking an elderly woman's money for a rocking horse.
"Nothing," I said.
I sat down on an old TV set, then I told him anyway.
"Ah, Amir," he sighed.
As it turned out, I didn't get to brood too much over what had happened, because later that week, Baba caught a cold. It started with a hacking cough and the sniffles. He got over the sniffles, but the cough persisted. He'd hack into his handkerchief and stow it in his pocket. I kept after him to get it checked, but he'd wave me away. He hated doctors and hospitals. To my knowledge, the only time Baba had ever gone to a doctor was the time he'd caught malaria in India. Then, 2 weeks later, I caught him coughing a wad of blood-stained phlegm into the toilet.
"How long have you been doing that?" I said.
"What's for dinner?" he said. "I'm taking you to the doctor." Even though Baba was a manager at the gas station, the owner hadn't offered him health insurance, and Baba, in his recklessness, hadn't insisted. So I took him to the county hospital in San Jose. The sallow, puffy-eyed doctor who saw us introduced himself as a second-year resident.
"He looks younger than you and sicker than me," Baba grumbled.
The resident sent us down for a chest x-ray. When the nurse called us back in, the resident was filling out a form.
"Take this to the front desk," he said, scribbling quickly.
"What is it?" I asked.
"A referral."
Scribble, scribble.
"For what?"
"Pulmonary clinic."
"What's that?"
He gave me a quick glance, pushed up his glasses, began scribbling again.
"He's got a spot on his right lung. I want them to check it out."
"A spot?" I said. The room suddenly too small, the air too thick.
"Cancer?"
Baba asked casually.
"Possible.
It's suspicious anyway," the doctor muttered.
"Can't you tell us more?"
I asked.
"Not really. Need a CAT scan first, then see the lung doctor."
He handed me the referral form.
"You said your father smokes, right?"
"Yes."
He nodded, looked from me to Baba and back again.
"They'll call you within 2 weeks."
I wanted to ask him how I was supposed to live with that word, suspicious, for 2 whole weeks. How was I supposed to eat, work, study,
How could he send me home with that word? I took the form and turned it in. That night, I waited until Baba fell asleep and then folded a blanket. I used it as a prayer rug. Bowing my head to the ground, I recited half-forgotten surahs from the Quran, verses the mullah had made us commit to memory in Kabul, and asked for kindness from a God I wasn't sure existed. I envied the mullah now, envied his faith and certainty. 2 weeks passed and no one called, and when I called them, they told me they had lost the referral. Was I sure I had turned it in? They said they would call in another 3 weeks. I raised hell and bargained the 3 weeks down to 1 for the CAT scan, 2 to see the doctor. The visit with the pulmonologist was going well, until Baba asked Dr. Schneider where he was from. Dr. Schneider said Russia. Baba lost it. "Excuse us, doctor," I said, pulling Baba aside. Dr. Schneider smiled and stood back, stethoscope still in hand. "Baba, I read Dr. Schneider's biography in the waiting room. He was born in Michigan. Michigan. He's American. A lot more American than you and I will ever be." "I don't care where he was born. He's Rusi," Baba said, grimacing like it was a dirty word. "His parents were Rusi. His grandparents were Rusi. I swear on your mother's face, I'll break his arm if he tries to touch me." "Dr. Schneider's parents fled from Shorawi. Don't you see? They escaped," I said. But Baba would hear none of it. Sometimes, I think the only thing he loved as much as his late wife was Afghanistan, his late country. I almost screamed with frustration. Instead, I sighed and turned to Dr. Schneider. "I'm sorry, doctor. This isn't going to work out." The next pulmonologist, Dr. Amoni, was Iranian and Baba approved. Dr. Amoni, a soft-spoken man with a crooked mustache and a mane of gray hair, told us he had reviewed the CAT scan results and that he would have to perform a procedure called a bronchoscopy to get a piece of the lung mass for pathology. He scheduled it for the following week. I thanked him as I helped Baba out of the office, thinking that now I had to live a whole week with this new word, mass, an even more ominous word than suspicious. I wish Suraya were there with me. It turned out that, like Satan, cancer had many names. Baba's was called oat cell carcinoma, advanced, inoperable. Baba asked Dr. Amoni for a prognosis. Dr. Amoni bit his lip and used the word grave. "There is chemotherapy, of course," he said, "but it would only be palliative." "What does that mean?" Baba asked. Dr. Amoni sighed. "It means it wouldn't change the outcome, just prolong it." "That's a clear answer, Dr. Amoni. Thank you for that," Baba said. "But no chemo medication for me." He had the same resolved look on his face as the day he had dropped the stack of food stamps on Mrs. Dobbin's desk. "But Baba, don't you challenge me in public, Amir, ever. Who do you think you are?" The rain General Tahiri had spoken about at the flea market was a few weeks late. But when we stepped out of Dr. Amoni's office, passing cars sprayed grimy water onto the sidewalks. Baba lit a cigarette. He smoked all the way to the car and all the way home. As he was slipping the key into the lobby door, I said, "I wish you'd give the chemo a chance, Baba." Baba pocketed the keys and pulled me out of the rain and under the building's striped awning. He kneaded me on the chest with the hand holding the cigarette. "Bas, I've made my decision." "What about me, Baba? What am I supposed to do?" I said, my eyes welling up. A look of disgust swept across his rain-soaked face. It was the same look he'd give me when, as a kid, I'd fall, scrape my knees and cry. It was the crying that brought it on then, the crying that brought it on now. "You're 22 years old, Amir. A grown man, you..." He opened his mouth and closed it, opened it again and reconsidered. Above us, rain drummed on the canvas awning. "What's going to happen to you?" you say. All those years, that's what I was trying to teach you, how to never have to ask that question.